So we're going to go back to our regular topic this week, which has been recently the 12 tribes. And for those who haven't been here, we started about a year and a half ago about personalities throughout the Torah. We started from Adam and we've gone forward since then. So now we're in the middle of discussing the 12 tribes. And I wanted to discuss this week the tribe of Yisachar. And a lot of the 12 tribes, there's not much known about them. You hear the name Yisachar, you might be aware it's one of the 12 tribes. Beyond that, it's hard to know what did he do, what's special about him. We can't forget that if they are the 12 tribes, each one is unique and special and has a contribution to Jewish people to offer. So the way that I like looking into the 12 tribes and figuring out what are their virtues is by looking at the blessings that are given to them by Yaakov at the end of his life. When Yaakov was on his deathbed, he gave each of the 12 tribes a bracha, and he describes the virtues of each of the 12 tribes. So I sort of want to pick apart this week the description of this of the tribe of Yisachar and draw the lessons from that for our lives. I just do want to preface that in Yisachar, as we'll see, he is known to be the Torah scholar of the 12 tribes. He's known to be a great Torah scholar who spent his time studying and teaching. And when we describe Yisachar, we're basically describing the life of a great Torah sage, which a lot of times seems out of our grasp. Being normal everyday people, it's out of our grasp sometimes to try to compare to one of the great Torah sages of history. But what we can draw out of it for our own sake is, number one, we should be able to understand what goes into being a Torah sage, which helps us respect our sages. That's number one. A lot of times we hear different names of great Torah scholars, like Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Rabbi Soloveitchik, all these different names. And you know that there's they deserve our respect. We know the things that they say, the psak they give, the different rulings they have in Jewish law are a solid understanding. We should accept them. But we don't really understand what goes into becoming a great Torah scholar in that way. So understanding Yisachar helps us understand what goes into becoming a great Torah scholar. And additionally, also, I think for us, on a more practical, personal level, it gives us a perspective on how Torah studies should fit into our lives. But the way that we see a great Torah sage studying Torah, the way that he approaches it, his perspective on Torah, should also impact us in our own way. So hopefully those two things will come out, will jump out at us as we go through the description of Yisachar. So let me just get to it in here. So there is the idea that Yisachar is known as a great Torah scholar. That's based on a verse. The clearest source of that is a verse in Divrei Yamim, the Book of Chronicles, which says, I think I have the quote here, which says that Yisachar was the one who everybody would go to for advice. Well, I can't track down the quote right this very second, but it says in the Book of Chronicles that they were the tribe that understood wisdom and would give advice to the other tribes as to how they should act. It's in here somewhere, but I want to waste your time as I track it down. So that was a quote from the Book of Chronicles. Beyond that, many people were aware of the famous agreement between Yisachar and Zebulun. Zebulun would support Yisachar as Yisachar studied all day. Zebulun would be involved in business, and he would support Yisachar as he was studying. So that's a famous idea, which does actually have practical ramifications as well for some of our great Torah scholars who do live with deals of that nature. Where you have somebody who's very successful in business helping support a Torah scholar so he can be engrossed in his studies. So that's another idea you see of Yisachar. But it's very strange then, now that we've seen that Yisachar is a tribe of Torah scholars, if you listen to Yaakov's blessing, it sort of strikes you in the beginning as very strange. If you read all the blessings Yaakov gives, so he describes a lot of the tribes in terms of analogies to animals. You know, we know Yehuda's like a mighty lion. You have the idea that, you know, Binyamin is like a wolf. You have the idea that Dan is like a snake. And if we think through it, you know, Naphtali is like a swift deer. So most of these animals, they do have some sort of positive image in our minds. I mean, even a snake, even though we look at a snake as sort of a negative type animal, there's still sort of like a majesty or some mystique to a snake, which does jump out at us. When we look at it, how it describes Yisachar, it's very strange. It says, Yisachar chamor gorim. Yisachar is a big-boned donkey. So if I were to call any of you a big-boned donkey, you'd probably smack me in the face, right? And when we think of all the animals that we would describe a great person to be like, I would never mention a donkey typically. A donkey usually has a negative connotation. You know, it's dirty, it's fat, it's slow. It's funny why he describes a donkey. You know, it's a big bone donkey, a big, fat, powerful donkey. So we have to understand what that analogy is. And the blessing continues, Rovitz Bein HaMishpasayim. He crouches down, and in the translation of Bein HaMishpasayim is actually in dispute, but we'll translate it for now like Rashi translates it, which means he crouches down between the borders of cities. Meaning, as he's at work, as he's carrying loads, he'll go to sleep on the road. He doesn't need to be put in a hotel. He doesn't need to be put in a stable. He'll just crouch down wherever he is and then go to sleep. And then it says that he saw a menucha, he saw tranquility, that it's good. He saw the land was pleasant. And he tilted his shoulder to bear more of a burden and became a servant. That's basically his blessing. So just to recap, he's a big-boned donkey who sleeps on the road. He sees that tranquility is good. And he sees the land is pleasant. He then tips over his shoulder to work and becomes a servant. So that's the blessing to Yisachar. So a very strange blessing. And even the last part of it, besides the fact he's a donkey, the saying that he saw that tranquility was good and then he became a servant, they seem to be opposites. If you think tranquility is good, then you sit down and relax. Why is it you see tranquility is good, but yet you go and start working hard? You become a servant, you tip over your shoulder to bear a burden. So what is this description the Torah is giving us? So I guess first and foremost, let's understand what the description of a donkey is. Why is he compared to a donkey? A donkey is definitely not a very flattering description, especially of a great Torah scholar. So Rashi explains that what does it mean to be a donkey? Rashi says here, he says, Sovel Ol Torah, that he bears the burden of Torah, like a strong donkey that carries a heavy load. So one positive thing about a donkey is a donkey is able to carry a very heavy load on his back. Other animals can't carry such heavy loads. They get tired, they'll break their back. Donkeys are known to carry very heavy loads. And before times of trucks, the donkey was the truck. Now, even if you go to the Mideast nowadays, it's still a donkey shoving things around. In Israel, I've seen it before, the Arabs use donkeys to shove things around. So donkeys are known to be the beast of burden, and they can carry a lot of weight on their back. So the analogy to a Talmud Chacham, to a Torah scholar, would be that they have to carry a large load in several ways. Torah itself is enormous. Understand the entire Torah, including the written Torah, the oral Torah, the commentaries, Jewish thought, and halacha, and everything else. There's such a scope of books out there. You walk into Yeshiva and Kent Mill, there's thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of svarim up on the wall. They have, I think the ceiling is about 20 feet tall. There's shelves going up to the ceiling, surrounding the entire room, totally packed full of books, and then they have more in that storage other places. So, I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's so much, and to be a great Torah scholar requires that you've taken that heavy load upon yourself. You say, I'm now going to commit myself to understanding all of this. In addition to that, there's responsibility. Somebody who becomes a Torah scholar has a great responsibility, number one, in terms of psak, in terms of ruling in halacha. That's a big responsibility. Someone comes and says, what should I do? They have to answer, it's okay, it's not okay, do it, don't do it. And sometimes it can be very serious decisions, very weighty issues, and we go to our Torah scholars to decide those issues. That's carrying a very heavy load. They carry the load for the community, I mean, caring for others. Usually you find at the heart of any major chesed program, you have the rabbi, you have the Torah scholar there, sort of moving it along, guiding it. And it has to be a sort of a stability which comes along with that. You have to be able to bear that heavy load. And then, overall, there's a responsibility for the entire Jewish people. I mean, the greatest of Torah scholars, talk about somebody like Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, or these great names we hear, they took upon themselves responsibility not just of their own communities, but of the entire world Jewry. And people would call them from all over the world with all sorts of questions, needing guidance, needing help, and it was nonstop pressure. You can read biographies of Torah scholars and the Gedolim, and really this nonstop, phone calls, letters, people knocking at their door, just nonstop issues they had to deal with. And that was the life they chose to embark on as they became the great sages. So you have to carry a very heavy load to be a great Torah scholar. Yisachar is this big-boned donkey. He's able to carry that heavy load. So that's like the first analogy you find of a donkey. So there is something positive to the donkey. It's not only an insult. the big bones actually do describe the fact that he can carry a heavy load. The Torah continues and says, Rovitz Bein HaMishpasayim, that he would crouch down between the borders. So on the road, he would crouch down. So the analogy, so Rashi says, what does that mean? That a donkey, when he's walking on the road day and night, he doesn't need to sleep in a stable. I mean, donkeys, I guess, are very durable, and they can sleep outside. And Rashi says, when he wants to rest, he just lays down, and he rests wherever he is. So certain animals require more care. They're more delicate. You know, they have more needs. A donkey is somebody who's something that will just, you know, when it gets tired, it'll lay down. Doesn't matter where it is, rain, snow, sun. It just goes to sleep. That's what it does. So the analogy to that would be, well, before I get to that, there's another description of what this means. I told you there's two different definitions. So that was according to Rashi's definition. The explanation of another commentary, the Sforno, so he says that this line means that he would sleep with his burden on his back. So they both discuss sleeping while at work. One's saying the donkey sleeps without having much care. He's not so delicate, he can sleep outside on the road. The other is saying that the donkey sleeps with the burden still on his back. So, but either way, the message is a similar message. In the analogy, a great Torah scholar, his job is not limited to 9 to 5. There's no hours. I mean, forgetting the greatest Torah scholars, people involved in any communal type of work, I mean, there's no hours to the job. It's always 24-7, you're on call. And you can't say, well, my job is till 5, I'm going to go home and I'm going to relax. They can't, and they don't say that. Rather, they're always working, and if they get tired, so they sleep, they go to sleep. But they don't have to stop, and there's no time to stop and relax and take care of myself. The idea of the great Torah scholar is that he's going to stop only when he has to, sleep when he has to, wake up as soon as he can, and he sleeps with the burden on his back. The burden is always there. He has to rest because he's human and has to rest. But that's something. But he never takes off the burden. So, and there's examples of this, and you can read biographies of great Torah scholars, and you do find very extreme examples. For instance, the great Vilna Gaon. So the Vilna Gaon, they say, only slept for 2 hours a day. And even that 2 hours is only in half-hour intervals. So he lived, if you can imagine. So yeah, that's a very extreme example. I mean, there's probably no one in alive today who could do such a thing. But the greatest of Torah scholars, they weren't so delicate, we'll say, like some certain animals might be that need to have a lot of care. They were able to, they're constantly working, constantly studying, constantly teaching. And when they're above, their eyes couldn't stay open, so they would fall down and open up again. But that's the description of the donkey, how the donkey's always hard at work, and if it needs to sleep, it sleeps on the job. That's what it does. I mean, you do find other extreme examples of, like, you know, you hear about some lawyers who'll be up all night, you know, there's such a thing too. But that's not a lifestyle. That's only, you know, for a certain job. For a Talmud Chacham, it's the lifestyle, constantly. So that's not uncommon to find a great Torah scholar who's up late at night, up early in the morning, you know, with very little sleep, because they're always working, they're always engaged, they're always on the job. And Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, they say that, you know, he needed to find time to study. When he became so famous, people were bothering him left and right with questions and advice, and he didn't have time to study anymore. But you have to keep on studying. He used to wake up, I think, at 4 in the morning, and his time he would allot to his own studies was 4 to 7 in the morning. Because the rest of the day, he was just totally swamped with the needs of the Jewish people. So he used to allot that, well, that time, just he would no phone calls, no nothing, 4 to 7 in the morning, he would study on his own. But they're constantly working. And also shows there has to be a willingness to commit to the studying. There's dedication, which is necessary. And there's a famous quote from the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. It says in Pirkei Avos that the way of Torah is that you should eat bread with salt, drink water in measure, and sleep on the ground. So you read that, it's kind of striking, because we don't view lifestyle as Jews as necessarily like a lifestyle of difficulty, that we have to oppress ourselves and only eat bread and water and salt. But the way that the commentators explain it is it's not saying this has to be this way, but the commitment is that even if it comes to that, you're still committed. So the idea that, especially a Torah scholar, sometimes, you know, life can be very difficult. They're so devoted, though, they're willing even to live like this. Torah requires that even if I have to live on bread and water and salt and sleep on the floor, my dedication to Torah is strong enough that I'm willing to do that for the sake of Torah study. So, I mean, if they have a more comfortable lifestyle, then great. It's not a requirement, but it shows the extent of the dedication. So that's part of also sleeping on the road. You're sleeping at work. You don't take care of your own needs. You're always working, and if you have to fall asleep, you fall asleep. You also see that the donkey, like Rashi explains, he doesn't need to sleep in a stable, which in the analogy would mean that the Talmud Chacham doesn't require material luxuries. He doesn't request for himself a beautiful home. He doesn't request for himself, you know, beautiful clothing, a beautiful car. He can make do on very little, because his focus is on the spiritual, on God, on other people, and not on his own material needs. So the donkey doesn't need to sleep in the house, Rashi says. The donkey will sleep on the road, wherever he needs to be. to throw in another story. So there's a famous story with the great Chofetz Chaim. Chofetz Chaim was in Europe, in his generation, really the greatest of all the scholars in Europe. To this very day, people were constantly studying the works of Chofetz Chaim. He wrote the Mishneh Berurah, which is really our main book of halacha nowadays. He's the one who wrote the book called Chofetz Chaim, which is about speaking Lashon Hara. I mean, he is held to be probably the greatest rabbi in Europe in his generation. And there's a story which is told that an American woman came to Europe with a request from Chofetz Chaim. And she went into his house, and she saw that his house, you know, was furnished very sparsely. It had very little furniture, and everything was a little rickety, and there was very little there. So she was coming from America, which in America our standard of living is quite different. And I guess she had access to money, and she said, like, I see that your home is like this, can I help you? What can I bring for you? Can I do something for you? Can I buy you some furniture? Can I fix something? So he said to her, let me ask you a question, where's your furniture? Well, she said, I mean, I'm traveling, my furniture is at home. He said, well, I'm just traveling too, I'm just traveling through this world, this is temporary for me. You know, my furniture is going to be in Olam Haba, the next world. This is all temporary. So that was his response to her, which I guess is why a Talmid Chacham should not be requesting material luxuries, because somebody who's a great Torah scholar realized this world is, we're just traveling through this world. This is temporary. It's like a, you know, 2-week trip to Europe, so it's a 100-year trip to, you know, this world. 120-year trip, we hope, to this world. But it's only a short trip, because eternity is not here. So Talmid Chacham doesn't request those material luxuries in his life. He's able to subsist on very little because he knows there's something else at the end which he's working towards. So he's always living with a mission in mind. Just like the donkey, the donkey doesn't need the house, in the analogy. So that's the first, I guess, two steps of this analogy. And then the Torah continues in the blessing to Yisachar, and it says, they saw that tranquility was good, and he saw that the land was pleasant. He saw tranquility was good, and the land was pleasant. So the idea of tranquility, when he says that he sees tranquility is good, we can have a different perspective on what does rest mean. The word is menucha, the word can mean rest, tranquility. So one perspective on it is like, I need an escape. So, you know, I'm working very hard, my job, I go on vacation for 2 weeks to escape from it. I can't stay working all year long. I need to have that escape. That's one perspective. Another perspective could be that, you know, I'm working very hard, I'm accomplishing. I just know that my body can't handle constant work, and it's going to be unhealthy for me to continue working. So I need a vacation so I can gain strength to go back to the job again and work hard. So it could be the same vacation, but it's different perspectives on it. So Yisachar, as our Talmud Chacham, as our prototype of a Talmud Chacham, he says that he saw that tranquility, that rest was good. He saw the land was pleasant, meaning that he understood that rest was good in his mission, that it's a tool for his mission. So the donkey who sleeps in his load, he understands that I have a mission to do. I need to rest right now. So I'll sleep with my load still upon me. I'm sleeping so that Samar can wake up and carry my load again. Talmid Chacham sees that rest is good. He sees that I need to take a rest. I need to go on vacation. But my vacation is only so that I have strength when I go back to get back to my job again. So that perspective of what makes tranquility so important is that I'm using my tranquility as a tool. It's not a goal. It's not an escape. But it's a tool so that I can go back into my mission appropriately. Donkey sleeps carrying his load because he's going to wake back up and carry the load once again, stronger, more awake, more alert. That's that analogy. There's actually a very interesting distinction you find. It's a halachic distinction in terms of halacha, but it has a lot of meaning also, in a philosophical way. If you think about the laws of making different brachas on mitzvahs, the blessings on a mitzvah. So, if we were to go and eat in a sukkah on Sukkot, so you make a bracha when you sit down to eat, you leave, when you come back the same day for next meal, you make a new bracha again on your sukkah. So every time you walk in your sukkah, you always make a new bracha. The Torah study is different. For Torah study, in the morning, in davening, in shacharis, there is a bracha for Torah study. And you make it once a day. And beyond that, there's no more bracha. So I say a bracha on Torah study in the morning. You know, I go off to work for 5 hours. I have a lunch break and I open up, you know, some Torah to learn. I don't need to make a new blessing. The same blessing I made in the morning still applies. And then I come home at night, and I want to open up my look at the parsha at night and learn some more. I don't need a blessing either. The blessing I said in the morning, it carries on the whole day. So the distinction, and how come when it comes to some mitzvahs, every time I do the mitzvah, I need a new blessing. When it comes to Torah study, my blessing in the morning covers the entire day through. So Tosfos explains that Torah is different because your mind's always on Torah. Meaning that the perspective of a Jew has to be that Torah study is my full-time, you know, occupation. I have to take breaks from it in order to make a living, in order to nap, in order to eat. I have to take breaks because I'm human and I have a lot of human needs. But my full-time occupation is always, my mind's always really on Torah study. I never really leave Torah study. I'm just setting it aside because I have to take care of something. I'm right back to it. So it's an interesting distinction. So halachically, that means that my blessing in the morning covers the entire day because my mind is always occupied with Torah study. Even when I'm at work, that's only just a temporary break. So I go back to the studying once again. That's the perspective we're supposed to have when it comes to the mitzvah of, let's say, eating in the sukkah, which is the example we were giving. So I eat in the sukkah in the morning. When I leave the sukkah, so I'm done. I'm not always thinking about my sukkah. When I go back later on sukkah, I eat again. I'll make a new blessing on my sukkah. But the reason I'm bringing up this whole point is to show that the perspective we're supposed to have is that Torah study is my full-time occupation. That's the perspective of a great Torah sage. Anything the person does in between, that's only in order as a tool because it's a necessity so that I can come back and study Torah once again. So if I don't have any food in the pantry and I can't eat, so I can't study Torah because I'm going to starve, so I have to go and eat. I have to go make some money. I have to go to work. If I don't eat, then I'm going to be weak. I can't study. If I don't sleep, I'm weak. I can't study. And the studying is the major focus. Everything else is a tool for that. So that's part of this idea of the Torah scholar who's sleeping with his load. Everything he does is with the load in mind. And let's throw in another story. It's good. It'll be for stories. Right? So you're talking about Torah scholars. There's a lot of stories about great Torah scholars. So there was a story with the great Rosh Yeshiva of the Telz Yeshiva in Cleveland, Rabbi Gifter. Rabbi Gifter said many times in his life an analogy on which he experienced himself. He said that one time he went to Mexico City to collect money, I think it was. So there was a certain businessman, wealthy, well-to-do businessman, who he's trying to track down so he could speak to him about a certain issue and ask for some money from him. So he went to his, he knocked on his door at home in the daytime. So his wife answered, said, well, he's at work. So he came back a little later, said he's still at work. He came back at night, he said he's still at work. Every time he knocked on the door, he was always at work. So finally, Rabbi Gifford tracked this man down and said to him, you know, do you ever go home? Like, you're always at work? Like, even in the middle of the night, I come to your door, you're always at work? So he said, well, you know, right now, during the daytime, I can deal with my customers in Mexico. As it gets later, so then we have time to deal with. So I start calling over to, I don't know, instruction. So, I guess you'd be going east, right? So, you're going west, right? So I keep calling my customers further west, and it gets to 3 in the morning, I'm already speaking to my customers in Asia, and whatever. He's saying that there's always another customer to speak with. So he would even be in his office 3 in the morning, speaking with customers in a different continent, because there's always something to do. So Rabbi Gifter used to use this as an analogy and said, this is what Torah study is supposed to be like. You know, but any opportunity I possibly have to study, I take. So during the daytime, you know, I grab any hour I have. As nighttime comes, I'm always focused on it. How can I achieve more of my Torah study? So this businessman, so at 3 in the morning, he was thinking, well, I can't speak to my customers in Mexico City, but I can start making phone calls to Asia. So the Torah scholar at 3 in the morning, he's also thinking, how can I grow in my Torah study? What can I do now? What else can I study? How can I improve? What should I review? Etc. And it's the analogy that's always constantly on his mind, that that's his full-time pursuit, and everything else sort of fits into the scheme. I'm sure this businessman ate lunch and ate dinner, but it was probably always at the office as he was thinking of the next person to call. that's all part of it. So Yisachar, it says he saw that tranquility was good. So Rashi explains on this. When the Torah says that Yisachar saw that tranquility was good and the land was pleasant, so Rashi says that he recognized that he had an inheritance in the land of Israel, which is very fruitful. So God awarded Yisachar with a very fruitful part of Israel. And his land is very successful, produced a lot. And the lesson to us in the bigger analogy is that financial success, when a person sees financial success, you can take it in two ways. You can say the financial success is now a sign that I should devote more time to my business and I can grow even more. Or it's that Hashem is giving me success so that to sustain my spiritual growth. See, Sakura understood that the success that God gave him in his land was to sustain his own spiritual endeavors. He said, I see God gave me great land, it's growing great fruits, so instead of devoting double the time to the land so I can make my next, 5 million, I'm going to take the extra time I have because I do have a steady income and focus it on my studies. And that's what Yisachar did. So he understands that the blessings given to him are blessings of are blessings to sustain his Torah study. And then it says, V'yitshich melispol, that he bent himself over to take on the burden. So again, it's a recognition that if God's giving me a certain blessing, it's so that I take on a burden at this point. I'm supposed to now take upon myself the burden of Torah. God's not giving me the blessing so that I can go off and just focus more on my fields. God gave me the blessing so that I can take on the burden of Torah. That'd be the flow. There's a midrash. Let's track this one down. I wanted to pull it for you. Here it is. The midrash that says it sort of describes what I was describing to you, how Yisachar perceived his success, his nice juicy fruits that he was able to grow in his land. So the midrash says that the fruits of Yisachar were very thick and juicy, and he used to take these fruits and go off into the sea, and other nations would see these fruits and they'd say, "How did such great, beautiful, juicy fruits grow?" So they would take it. This is when the Jews were all in Israel, I guess is the description of this. And they would take it on the ship, and other nations would see, and they'd see these beautiful fruits from Israel. And they would say, how would you get such nice fruits? And they would respond to the nations who were asking this question. They would say, you are totally amazed by these fruits. You'd be even more amazed by the fact that the owners of these fruits are not even tending to their fields. They're studying Torah all day long. So that would even amaze you even more. And many people, it says, converted because of this circumstance. So the idea is that when Yisachar saw these fruits were so juicy and nice, he immediately focused himself even stronger and more dedicated manner to his Torah studies. And people would look at this and say, that's incredible. You know, he has some amazing farming technique and able to produce such nice fruits. The answer was no. His technique was he was doing God's will. He focused himself on God. And through that, God was blessing his fruits and giving him such nice juicy fruits. So that's, I guess, his perspective on wealth. So the perspective of a Talmud Chacham on wealth, even if one becomes wealthy, it's that wealth is supposed to be a tool for me to support me in my focus and dedication to my studies. That's the perspective of the great Torah scholar. And then this last point in the verse, it says that he then became a servant. So to me, this is a very powerful statement. Because if we view the picture right now, you have somebody who is financially well off, somebody who is a great scholar, they're leaders, they give guidance to others. So that could lead to arrogance. You know, it could lead to somebody who says, I'm not your servant, I'm your king, I'm your leader. I'm your scholar. You have to listen to me. I enjoy my power. I'm going to be up on my pedestal. I get to give orders. That could be one perspective they could take on it. But the Torah says that the blessing given to Yisachar, which is what they should become, is that they should become servants to the Jewish people. Because if you view the lives of these great Torah scholars, they act very humble. They don't view themselves as powerful kings, powerful leaders. But there's a certain humility which comes with it. And they view themselves as they have a responsibility towards the Jewish people. And it's not that we don't have a responsibility towards them as our leaders, they're responsible towards us. But that's how they're supposed to be themselves, and that's how they do it themselves. And that humility comes along with it. So the Torah describes that they became servants. After seeing this whole beautiful image of a Torah scholar, they presented themselves as servants to the Jewish people. They became our servants. And they had felt the responsibility day and night to take care of us. We don't have to take care of them. They're not up on a pedestal giving orders, but they take care of us. And that's the attitude that comes with it. There's actually a fascinating story in the Gemara. And this one, obviously, it requires more explanation than I'm going to give to it right now. But I guess it gives you an image of this concept. I don't remember, I wasn't able to look it up, so I don't remember the names of the story. But the Gemara describes two rabbis, and they're being executed, I think, by the Romans. And when two great rabbis are executed, so they try to think about their lives. Why did I deserve this? Is there something I did in my life which would cause God to bring me to this point in my life? So he asked his friend who was with them. They were both being executed together. He said, can you think of anything that I've done that I should deserve this? So the other rabbi responded to him. did anybody ever come to you with a question, and you told them, please wait a minute while I finish my breakfast? And he said, yeah, that's happened a few times. Now, the person came, and I said, give me 1 minute, I want to finish my coffee, and I'll, whatever it was, I don't make coffee back then, but I want to finish my breakfast, and I'll get back to you. So he said, that's the reason. He said, you have to understand, and that's with the Gemara story. But what it's saying is that, I mean, again, this is way far beyond, you know, our level. But on their level, as the greatest sages, the great Torah scholars, this is the times of the Gemara, these are really our greatest Torah scholars, saying that you are a servant to the Jewish people. You can't, you know, a servant doesn't tell the king, I have to finish my coffee, wait a minute. As soon as the king walks in, you get up, and you do what the king needs. The Torah scholar is our servant. We should treat him as a servant. The Torah scholar has to have the attitude, I am a servant to the people. If someone comes in and has a need, I need to put my needs aside and work with them. If I say, let me finish my coffee for 1 minute, then I'm already doing myself with some slight, I guess, perspective of arrogance, not as a servant. And that's already a reason which the Gemara says he deserved to be killed. Which, again, I told you, needs more explanation than I can give it right now. But at least you see the message that they should view themselves, the responsibility they have for people as a servitude towards us. It's not leadership, they're not kings, but they are servants to the people. And that's how they act. I mean, the great Torah scholars, like I was saying before, their phone's ringing off the hook entire day long, people are knocking at their doors, they're receiving letters, they're being asked to attend functions, they're being asked to read this book, answer this question, approve this organization, help us raise money for this, help us raise money for that, give this person advice. It's nonstop, constant pressure. And they don't say, back off, I need my time, get away, I'll tell you when I'm ready. They just jump right into it. Because that's how their humility comes along with Torah study. And they have such a humility and such a they feel such responsibility towards the people that's how they live their lives. So, again, a lot of these thoughts are very high levels and beyond the reach of a normal human being. But this is how we're describing what a Torah scholar is supposed to be. And there are people who live nowadays that do live like this. You know, they still exist. They're our greatest sages, the great Gedolim, they do live like this. You can read very modern accounts. You can even speak to them, you can read books, and you read stories, just like Yisachar. You have stories with, they don't sleep, and they hardly have time to eat, and they're constantly busy, and there's constant pressure, but they're always going out of their way to help others and feeling the responsibility to carry the load for the entire Jewish people. Another point here, which I think is worthwhile mentioning, is we discussed the idea of the tranquility. So the Torah scholar sees tranquility, then it's good. So, and then it says, and what did he do? Yisachar saw tranquility was good, and then he bent himself over to serve. So we discussed some perspectives to that. But there's another perspective on that as well, which is that I think that there's a misconception, which probably most of us live with, and it's definitely an American ideal, which is that true tranquility is in doing nothing, basically. Right? People work their entire lives so they can retire to play golf, Or, we make the big goals in our lives, the vacation. And we have to realize that those are important things that we've gained a lot from. But if we lived our whole lives on vacation, we'd get restless. People who take vacations for, months and months and months and months, at a certain point, they get sick of it. They don't want to be on vacation anymore. People told me this. And people who are retired and they play golf for 3 years, suddenly they feel like their lives are getting boring, they get depressed, they feel restless, they need to accomplish something in their lives. Because we have to redefine, the tranquility doesn't mean doing nothing. Ultimately, what makes us restless is, doing nothing makes us restless. And accomplishing things makes us feel at rest. So we definitely need our breaks, and we need our vacations, and playing golf is a good break, the vacations are very helpful. But ultimately, if we're not engaged in being productive, it can really take a toll on us, and that's not really rest. Rest is when we feel that we're accomplishing what we need to. We fit ourselves into the groove of what we're supposed to be doing in life, and we feel comfortable with what we're doing. We feel tranquil. We feel successful. We feel accomplished. If we are doing nothing, if menucha, if rest means doing absolutely nothing, then that does make us restless. And I think all of us have experienced that. Even sometimes, even this one day where I say I want to relax. So I won't do anything in a few hours. 3 hours later, I'm already like, okay, I got this something. I can't sit around anymore. I can't mess on the couch for so long. We feel a need as humans to act and to accomplish. So it applies on a little level and it applies on a grand level. But this perspective here is that he saw tranquility was good, so he bent over his shoulders to work. Means that sometimes working brings tranquility. Now, I'm not saying every job is going to make you feel tranquil. What I'm saying is that the concept of accomplishment, the concept of being productive, I think that really brings the tranquility. Doing nothing doesn't bring tranquility. Doing nothing usually brings to depression or brings to feeling restless. I think most people feel that they need to have at least those points throughout their day that they're doing something which is productive, or else it really throws them off. So that's part of seeing that rest is good, and then tipping over your shoulder to work. So so I guess just to sum up, it's 2:15 now. But so this is a picture of a very great person. This is describing what a true gadol, the greatest leader, the greatest Torah scholars, are supposed to live their lives like. And so first of all, I preface that we're supposed to gain a certain respect for these people. And people do live like this, those who really live like this, we really have to understand how devoted, how dedicated they are, how much they're depriving themselves of their own needs to serve the people and to serve God and to feel responsibility. And when you hear a name like, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, or I mentioned Rabbi Soloveitchik, or Rabbi Eliashiv, or Rabbi Shlomo, so all these great names of our greatest scholars, so they did live like this, and those who are alive still do live like this. And now, instead of it being a name, we should realize how much respect and how much we owe to them for being so dedicated and devoted to the welfare of the Jewish people. So I guess that's one lesson we can gain from seeing what Yisachar is all about. And again, I encourage you to pick up the biography of a great gadol, read about it, and you'll see these stories, and you'll see how it fits right in this description. That's number one. And number two, by seeing the image of these people, so we see certain ideals to strive towards. I mean, most of them, to live like this is probably out of our reach. But there are certain ideals which we can take out of it. So for instance, humility. So we see that the greatest of the gadolim, as great as they are, as wise, as intelligent, as devoted, as dedicated, as much as we need them, they're totally humble. The greatest Torah scholar ever was Moshe, and he is called the most humble of all people, right? So to see these people and see how humble it is. Sometimes for us, we might excel in one area, and suddenly we feel all good about ourselves. The arrogance sets in. But you realize that with accomplishment has to come humility. We realize that I've accomplished, I have something to offer to others, I can't use it as a way to promote myself on top of everybody. I have to take it as a responsibility to help serve others and help other people. We can see the dedication of these great people. And even though for us to devote ourselves in that way is totally unrealistic, but we have to sometimes dedicate ourselves a little bit more, to devote ourselves a little bit more, even it may be uncomfortable. Instead of saying I'm gonna live my life sleeping 2 hours a night, but even to take extra 5 minutes when it's inconvenient, use that 5 minutes for davening or for studying or for chesed or something in the service of Hashem, even when it's inconvenient time. So that, on our level, would be equivalent to sleeping 2 hours a night for their level. For our level, we can translate down to much smaller steps, but it still shows our dedication and our devotion to Hashem and to the Jewish people. And there's also the element of responsibility, to understand that the accomplishments we do have become responsibilities for us to help others, to serve others. That's something to gain from this as well. Yisachar took his responsibility and decided that I'm going to become a servant to other people. So to say that we're going to really, truly be servants to others, again, is an extreme. But to say that I have to recognize that I have a certain talent or ability, and I can use that ability to help another person, I shouldn't say it's my responsibility. It's not just an extra special nice thing I'm going to do to help somebody else. I have a responsibility to take my talent and use it for the good of others. So their talents, they might use for the good of others 24 hours a day, and their talents may be knowing everything in the world to possibly know. And our talents might be in a different field, in a different level, not to the same extent, but to understand that a responsibility comes along with that is an important understanding. And then overall, it gives us, I think, a perspective on life in general, which is that slowly we should always be heading towards the goal that my full-time occupation is service of God. Everything else I do should be used as a tool for that occupation. And we can, if we slowly, piece by piece, refocus ourselves daily, so it can really help change our lives. And every day we have in mind that my full-time occupation has to be focusing on what does God want out of me. And everything else fit in that picture. So this doesn't happen instantly. I mean, to live our lives like that, it's not always on our mind, our perspective is not always that way. But to understand that we could slowly put certain pieces in place, which make certain parts of our day more focused on God, We understand that certain things which we have to do are part of the picture. We use as tools to serve God. That's part of the understanding. And overall, to understand that what we call rest leads to restlessness, and that productivity leads to tranquility. That's what we can definitely take to heart. And we all experience that, and to realize that we're going to feel the most at peace when we feel accomplished. And we feel unaccomplished, we feel like we're wasting our time, we're going to feel restless, and we're not going to feel good about ourselves. And that's something that all of us can probably use more of in our lives, to understand that even though sometimes it's nice to relax, a lot of times we relax too long, we don't feel good about it. We'd rather be doing something productive with ourselves. So all these lessons you can draw out of yourself, of course. So he'll be placed on that pedestal as a role model, as a paradigm. But in our lives, we can draw little lessons from it to apply to ourselves as well. And hopefully with that, we'll be able to let it impact us and change us around. You have any questions?
Good.